This is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
The world's biggest structure built by living organisms is not Tokyo or New York. It is the Great Barrier Reef off Queensland, Australia, in the Coral Sea. It is over 1,400 miles long, 2,300 kilometers. It is a nursery for countless ocean species. And, as we learn in a horrifying new scientific report, the Great Barrier Reef is dying, killed by the hot seas of global warming. The title of the new paper published in the journal Nature is Global Warming Transforms Coral Reef Assemblages. We have reached co-author Dr. C. Mark Eakin. Mark is the coordinator of the Coral Reef Watch, run by NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And as they say at that site, NOAA's Coral Reef Watch provides the only source of satellite-based monitoring, alerts, and warnings of upcoming coral mass bleaching events. From Maryland, Mark Eakin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
I've just spoken with Dr. Eric Oliver, whose team published a paper on global increases of marine heat waves. Tell us what happened to the sea temperatures off Queensland's coast of Australia in 2016.
Yes, and in fact, that's a very good paper to have come out just before our paper, because that's what we were looking at, is one of these marine heat waves, actually two of them, that struck Australia's Great Barrier Reef. This was, in fact, part of a global coral mass bleaching event. This was the third global bleaching event to ever occur. The first was in 1998, the second in 2010, and this one surprisingly lasted for 3 years, from 2014 to 2017, including the two events on the Great Barrier Reef in 2016 and 2017. So in 2016, the Great Barrier Reef was hit by one of these marine heat waves, striking mostly the northern and far northern part of the Great Barrier Reef. That section, unfortunately for the corals, was one that had never seen heat stress like this before. So these sort of marine heat waves had not hit the northern Great Barrier Reef, and the corals were much more sensitive than most corals are because they hadn't been exposed to these kinds of conditions. And so the heat wave struck. We had mass coral bleaching and mortality. And in fact, the corals up there in the northern section were bleaching and dying at about half the level of heat stress that we usually see.
And how did this team and this project get going?
So the work being done in Australia is a part of ongoing efforts through James Cook University, the Australian Research Council Center of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies, the Australian Institute of Marine Science, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, and they have efforts going on to study coral reefs on the Great Barrier Reef on an ongoing basis. And in fact, Australian Institute of Marine Science has, in the past, when these large-scale bleaching events have hit in Australia, two of them being in 98 and 2002, they had used overflights, aircraft overflights, to see how much bleaching there was, as well as having divers who go out and look in the water to see what the after effects were, going out months later to see how much coral may have died. At the same time, NOAA's Coral Reef Watch that I run is an organization that's always monitoring for coral bleaching everywhere in the world, using a combination of satellite monitoring as well as climate models. And so since we have the data on the amount of heat stress that the corals exhibited, they had the data from the work, both the aerial surveys and now the in-water surveys, to understand how much coral had bleached and died. We worked together on this paper. It's actually the third of the papers that we've worked together on regarding these bleaching events.
Now, you say it was pretty well a three-year event of ocean heating, but I was pretty shocked at the figures that came out from just the 2016 period. I mean, your paper lists almost 4,000 different reefs. How much was lost in that period just in 2016?
In 2016 alone, the Great Barrier Reef lost just under 30% of its corals. So it's a huge number of corals. And, you know, most of that, because the majority of the heat and the most sensitive corals were both together in the northern part, the majority of the corals that died in 2016 were up in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef.
which happens to be a huge tourism area, so people expecting to see bright coral will still see some, I'm told by the Australians, but less and less as we go on. I wanted to talk about two different ways these changes show up that you talk about in the paper. The first is something called three-dimensionality. What does that mean?
Well, coral reefs are very important because they provide habitats for so many different animals, and they do that by forming structure. So, you know, grass is a plant, trees are plants, but grass and trees provide different kind of structure to animals that live in them. And coral reefs are the same way. Coral reefs provide that three-dimensional structures like trees do. So coral reefs actually serve very much the same way that forests do in providing a lot of structure. And so it's those corals that provide, you know, the corals that grow up in branching forms and tabular forms and really provide that relief that are the ones that provide the most and the most variety of habitat for other animals. And in fact, it's those fast-growing corals, the ones that provide most of that structure, are the ones that were hit the hardest.
Now, when they die, do they just topple over, or do they have to be hit by storms, or how do they lose that dimensionality?
Well, you're right. In one case, it is that they will be hit by storms, and they'll be weakened at that point. The other thing, and some other work that we've been doing with additional colleagues, has found that when these events happen, you actually very quickly start seeing bioerosion, or the breakdown of the reef by natural processes. Every coral reef is a balance between processes to build the reef and destroy the reef. I mean, if that weren't the case, the entire ocean bottom would be covered with coral reef. So coral reefs are constantly being broken down by fish like parrotfish, sea urchins and things that crawl around and scrape away the surface, worms and crabs and types of shellfish like mussels that will bore into the reef, and even sponges and types of algae and bacteria that will make pores inside of the coral. And all of these weaken the structure, break it down, turn reef material into sand, and that's how you get a lot of the sand on the beaches, especially along the Great Barrier Reef. The shoreline is covered with the sand that's been formed by corals. But all of these forces will start to take over and will very quickly start breaking things down. In fact, in Hawaii, as a part of a bleaching we had in 2014 in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, we saw a dramatic reduction in the amount of structure on that reef in under a year.
So a lot of those creatures that you've been talking about, I guess, are the second aspect discussed in the paper, which is labeled ecological functioning. Do you want to talk about that briefly?
That's right. So if you're going to have a very diverse coral reef ecosystem, first, you have to have a variety of habitats formed by a diverse group of corals. If you have nothing but the same corals, and in fact, the ones that survive best are these massive or boulder corals, they just look like big rocks. They don't provide a lot of hiding holes for animals on the reef. And so when you have all these branching structures and tabular structures and folio structures, you know, things that are shaped in all kinds of weird and wonderful shapes, you have all kinds of habitat for animals, whether it's fish, shrimp, crabs, worms, you name it. The Great Barrier Reef, just like any coral reef, is a very diverse habitat. And especially in the north, it's more diverse than the rest of the Great Barrier Reef. And so when these corals die, you immediately start losing some of those fish and other organisms that will no longer have their homes, they'll no longer have the sources of productivity. And so it not only causes a breakdown in the corals themselves, but a breakdown of the actual ecosystem as a whole.
And how much above normal heat did those waters go?
So the way we measure this heat stress is not in degrees, but in something called degree weeks. So if you imagine you have a hot day, that's stressful, but it's one day. Heat waves that cause problem on land and where people, you know, die from heat during heat waves, it's because those events are not only hot, but they continue for days and days and days. Well, these marine heat waves are lasting for weeks to even a few months. And during that time, the temperature is above normal. So if you have temperatures that are, say, 2 degrees Celsius above the normal warmest month temperature, then we'll measure that as 2-degree weeks of stress. If the following week you have another week of 2 degrees, then you're now up to 4-degree weeks of stress. Normally, though, it doesn't go at levels quite that high. The temperatures usually during these events are in the range of 1 to 2 degrees Celsius above the normal maximum. And so when we add these up, you get values of heat stress that normally at 4-degree weeks of stress, you see significant bleaching. And at 8-degree weeks of stress, you see widespread bleaching and significant mortality. In this event, in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef, they were seeing bleaching at 2-degree weeks of stress and starting to see mortality as, in some cases, as low as 3-degree weeks of stress. So they were really being affected at a lower level than we're used to.
But I would presume that's because they're closer to the tropics so that there is less normal variation, whereas as you get towards the poles, there is more variation, so maybe the creatures are more used to it.
Well, that's true, but it's not a matter of variation that we're talking about here. It's how much warmer it is than normal. So, you know, there are coral reefs in places that have a lot of variability. I mean, you know, places like Florida, you know, temperatures will swing much more up and down than they will in the southern Caribbean. Same thing on the Great Barrier Reef. When you get to the southern Great Barrier Reef, which, of course, is closer to the pole, they have more temperature variation normally than they do in the northern Great Barrier Reef, which is near the equator. But the concern isn't that total amount of variability, but how far they get above that upper limit that the corals are used to.
Were there particular conditions like an El Nino or La Nina or something else that led to this long-standing marine heat wave off the coast of Australia?
There was. In fact, that was a part of what was going on in this global bleaching event. We usually see the most bleaching going on during the second year of an El Nino. And in fact, I mentioned those previous global bleaching events. The 98 event and the 2010 event were both in years, in the second year of an El Nino. Well, in 2014, we started seeing a lot of heat stress, and we saw what looked like was going to be an El Nino. We were expecting a 2014-2015 El Nino. The ocean heated up in ways that looked like an El Nino, but the atmosphere never responded, and you need to have both in place to kick in and really form an El Nino. So as a result, there wasn't a 2014-2015 El Nino. We joke about it being the El No-Show. But in 2015, then it started up again. We had the heat in the ocean. The atmosphere responded. And we had a 2015-2016 El Nino. And so what you're seeing at this point was that this El Nino was in place when the bleaching occurred in 2016. Now, interestingly enough, that stopped. We switched into La Nina conditions, and the 2017 marine heat wave that was the next year in Australia occurred during La Nina conditions. So one of the things that's important here is that we're no longer just seeing these things driven by El Nino or La Nina, but instead the warming that's gone on as a part of climate change has increased the temperatures of the ocean so that they're close to those thermal limits already. So it takes very little to push it over the top.
So, Mark, looking into your own private research, separate from this paper, I want to ask you, aside from the global warming caused by our greenhouse gases, does the presence of more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere affect coral directly?
It does, but in a secondary way. Corals build their skeletons of calcium carbonate, in other words, limestone. To do that, they have to have plenty of carbonate in the water. That is something that is harder for the corals to build their skeletons out of calcium carbonate when the water is more acidic. When you have more acid in the water, they don't build their skeletons as well. And the organisms that will naturally erode coral reefs are able to do that even faster. So when we have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, more carbon dioxide goes into the water. That carbon dioxide dissociates and becomes carbonic acid, and it's a more acidic condition that's harder for corals to build their skeletons and easier for organisms like boring sponges and such to erode the reef. It's not something, though, that has a major effect on bleaching. There is some effect in some corals. It's been shown that some corals become more sensitive to high temperatures when the water is more acidic. But it's not true of all corals. In fact, we're not really sure just how widespread that is. Most corals do grow more slowly, but that really comes into play after an event like this, and you're looking to see how well the reef can recover.
In June 2016, as this disaster unfolded, I interviewed the world's greatest coral expert, Charlie Varan. He'd just flown back from looking at the reefs, his life work of exploring and cataloging the wonderful world of coral was being killed off. How are Australian scientists you've worked with taking this terrible news about the coral?
Oh, well, they've been living through it. It's been a bit of a nightmare in most cases, where reefs that they've been studying for years have been just completely destroyed. Now, you know, you have to keep in mind, though, that we're not saying the entire Great Barrier Reef is gone. It killed, say, you know, somewhere in the range of about a billion corals, but there's still about a billion corals left on the Great Barrier Reef. 2016, bleaching was mostly on. There was a bit of bleaching farther south, but not too far. The 2017 event then hit more in the central Great Barrier Reef. And the central Great Barrier Reef is more the area where tourists go, and there are a lot of activities. So, you know, between those, there was a lot of destruction. And in fact, in the 2 years combined, the Great Barrier Reef lost about half of all of its corals. So we're looking at an area where a lot of reefs are in bad shape. Some reefs are still surviving. Some corals are still surviving. And so most of the scientists are at the same time trying to document what happened and the problems of that bleaching event while trying to find ways to help the reef recover from these insults.
You know, when the ice, the Arctic sea ice, retreated in 2007 and it was jaw-dropping, it was unexpected, I was really shocked. I thought, all right, this is climate change, but I think this is another one of those events, but it hasn't really made the public consciousness outside of Australia of what is happening there.
Yeah, it's a big problem that people aren't realizing how much climate change is already going on and going on all around them. We never saw mass coral bleaching events before 1983, that really big El Nino that it was occurring then. We never saw global bleaching events until 1998, and these have been increasing in frequency and intensity. Another paper that many members of the same team had in the journal Science about 2 months ago, we were able to analyze records from 100 sites around the world, coral reef sites, and we found that where in the 1980s we were seeing severe bleaching events once every 30 years, now we're seeing them once every 6 years. So this is a real acceleration. One thing that I would encourage your listeners to do if they haven't seen it yet and want to know more about this is watch the film Chasing Coral. You mentioned Charlie Varan. Charlie is in it. I'm in it briefly. I was one of the chief scientific advisors for it. And that film, Chasing Coral, really does a wonderful job of showing what's happening to the reefs, but does it while you follow the adventure of filmmakers and scientists and videographers who are trying to capture this bleaching event as it went on. So the 2016 bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef we're talking about right now is actually a major part of that film.
I will track that film down and put a link to it in my blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, the world's largest green radio show on nonprofit stations. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Mark Eakin from NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. We're talking about the latest assessment of coral death in the Great Barrier Reef off Australia's coast. And I think that, you know, is it too much to say that the reef system is becoming dead, or is it damaged? Do we expect recovery?
So what we've seen is the collapse of many of those coral reefs. I mean, you know, you think about what happens if there's, say, a massive forest fire. Every tree isn't dead, but it's no longer functioning as a forest ecosystem. The trees aren't there. They don't provide the same habitats. The productivity isn't there. You have to see if you're going to have that recovery to come back as a forest, and that takes time. And it takes time for reefs to come back as well. Coral reefs that have suffered this sort of widespread coral death, you can start to see recovery in 10 to 15 years as you get a lot of the fastest growing corals coming back. But that's like having that forest fire and then coming back with shrubs. They're part of the process. They do provide cover, but they're not the whole thing. You've lost your big old trees, or in this case, your big old corals as well. And corals that take decades to centuries to grow in the first place take decades to centuries to recover as well. So yes, reefs can recover, but as I was saying, that recent paper we had in Science says that we're looking at the return of severe bleaching events once every 6 years, but yet even for that initial growth of coral cover, it takes 10 to 15. So we already are at a point where the recovery is taking longer than the return time of the events.
So now with this new paper in Nature, we do have a big red alarm flashing about a collapse in our environment. Is there anything to be done about this?
There is. There are very important things we need to be doing. And it's important that we all keep in mind that those of us who are working with this on a daily basis and realize how bad it is, we haven't given up hope. We certainly believe that we're going to have coral reefs in the future if we do our part and allow the reefs to do theirs. So what are some of those things? The first is we need to be dealing with climate change. The Paris Agreement calls for keeping temperature increase around the globe, the global average, to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial conditions. And it has a second target that it calls for efforts to keep long-term temperatures at 1.5 degrees or below. Well, actually, for coral reefs, 1.5 is what we need. Anything above 1.5 is going to be bad for reefs. Anything above 2 is going to be catastrophic. And so we need to be working on dealing with climate change by reducing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You'll notice I didn't say reducing emissions, because it's not about just removing emissions. We also need to be thinking about negative emissions. How can we pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and clean up that part of our air that has been polluted but we just can't see? The next thing, though, is we need to be reducing local stress. Problems like land-based sources of pollution, you know, runoff of fertilizer, nutrients, runoff of sediments from poor land use. You know, these are all problems that have been facing coral reefs and continue to. Overfishing or destructive practices of fishing, habitat destruction, you know, these are all really important things. And by reducing those stressors, it helps the reefs have a better chance of recovering. But now we need to be looking at some much more dramatic things. And in Australia, they're even looking at installing large fans that, you know, big propellers that will draw cooler water up and pump it onto the reefs at time that that the bleaching is going on. There also is talk about ships that will spray seawater into the air, producing low-level boundary, you know, marine boundary layer clouds that can shade and cool the waters. So, you know, there are some actual direct actions we can take. The other one is the work that's going on coral restoration. The coral nurseries have been a great advance, especially for growing fast-growing corals, and there's some wonderful efforts underway. But one of the problems there is you never restore a habitat until you've removed the problem that killed things in the first place. And here with climate change, we're continuing to see that rising temperature. So there are teams that are working on selectively breeding corals that are better able to survive the future and using those as a part of these restoration activities. So there's a whole suite of things that are either underway or being contemplated that we need to be taking care of. But if we don't deal with that first one, if we don't address climate change, we shouldn't even bother with the rest.
And I would add one more thing. Let's not build a great big coal shipping port right near the reef as well, but We'll see whether that ever happens. How do our listeners find Coral Reef Watch, and how do they use it when they get there?
So Coral Reef Watch is easy to find online. It's coralreefwatch.noaa.gov. You can also find us at Coral Reef Watch on Twitter and Facebook. Most of our tools and materials are available on the website. You can go in there, and there are maps showing where the heat stress is potentially causing coral bleaching all around the world right now. There are detailed maps and tools with things like the gauges, like you see a fire danger when you go into a forest. We have bleaching danger gauges on the pages for different places. So whether you want to know about the Great Barrier Reef, whether you want to know about Florida, whether you want to know about Hawaii, you know, all of these are places that you can look at and see what the current heat stress levels are and what the climate models tell us are likely to be seeing in the about 4 months out. We can predict about 4 months ahead with pretty good accuracy. And so they can go through and do all of that. And if they live near a reef or have a reef they're particularly concerned about, they can sign up for email alerts, and they'll be alerted only when there's a change in the heat stress level on those reefs. And so we do this for all around the world. It's not just the U.S. So, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, Sri Lanka, Kiribati, or Florida, it's all the same.
One last thing. You just returned from Puerto Rico after yet another island-wide blackout, and that was the scene of a super hurricane, which we think climate change added to it. What is your sense of the feeling that people had there when the lights went out again?
Oh, again? They've become rather resigned to it. There was, in fact, just an outage that occurred last week that took out the power to 850 or 900,000 people in San Juan. This was bigger. It took out the power grid for the entire island. You're dealing with a Commonwealth of the U.S. that is not treated as though it's part of the U.S. It also is an area that is very poor and has very limited infrastructure by U.S. standards. So they don't have a very robust power grid, and so when power goes out, it's a lot tougher. So there's a lot that needs to be done there, and they know it. But they're also dealing with big, major economic problems that preceded the hurricane. So they're working through it, and they're trying to get help from people to deal with things, while at the same time they're still, you know, there are people without roofs and people who have not had power since Hurricane Maria came through last year, and we're just a little more than a month away from the beginning of the next hurricane season.
Well, to the people of Puerto Rico, we love you, and really we have the responsibility that these storms have become so extreme, in my opinion, because of our longstanding greenhouse gas emissions. But really, we've been talking about coral throughout this, and especially I want to encourage people to go and visit Coral Reef Watch. Our guest, Dr. Mark Eakin, is the coordinator of NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. He's the author of the paper published April 18th, 2018, co-author, I should say, in the journal Nature, titled Global Warming Transforms Coral Reef Assemblages. There's a lot to it. I encourage you to go and look at it. The lead author is Professor Terry P. Hughes, and he is from the ARC Center of Excellence Coral Reef Studies in Australia. Find links to the science and this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your busy time with us.
Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to spend that time with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. My listeners educate me, as do my guests. Feel free to write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Join us again next week for more Radio EcoShock.